Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Well, coming up at 12:30 today, we'll talk with a clinical psychologist who specializes in the impact of culture on female identity and relationship development. Her new book is called Why Women Settle for One-Sided Relationships, and it examines what she calls sextimacy, when women settle for sex but are really looking for intimacy and emotional connection. And of course, we do know men who settle for this too. We also have a little change in programming today. Tess Cacciatore was going to join us today to talk about a growing and very disturbing issue. However, she had a last-minute conflict, so she'll join us next week instead. It's going to be a difficult subject to hear about, but I think it's really important, so don't miss next week's show with Tess Cacciatore of the Global Women's Empowerment Network. So I'm going to bring Eric Ryder in here and somebody else in just a moment. You know, it's funny how things work out, because when I was booking today's show, totally forgot it was our 6th anniversary this month. So Eric Ryder, of course, is always here in the studio with me. Hi, Eric. Welcome.
Good afternoon, and big congratulations on 6 fantastic years here doing the show. And, of course, you've been here doing shows on the station for longer than 6 years. I think it's been about nine years.
We're
closing in on a fantastic decade, I think.
There we go. Oh, my gosh. Where does time go, you know?
But you really started to shine and develop your own thing 6 years ago when you brought forth the Conversations Live.
Yeah. And so I wanted to have, you know, since we have this time, I switched Tess around. And so I thought we have a chance to talk with, you know, people that you don't normally, our listeners don't normally get to hear. I also have on the phone David Vanver, who is an integral part of our team too. David, say hi to everyone.
Hello, everybody.
Well, David used to work somewhat in radio, and he's been working with me for 2 years. Tell us what you do, David.
Well, basically, I write all the web content, or I tweak it to make it appropriate for Conversations Live. And every week, I make sure the podcast gets uploaded to the website, just to make sure that, you know, everything's done promptly.
And a very important part that is, too.
Absolutely.
We all know we've had our fair share of technical challenges, right?
And they never end.
And David lives down Lacey Way. So we've worked together for 2 years, but we've actually only met once, David, haven't we?
Yeah, it was at the very beginning, before I even started.
Yeah, and I think I've only actually talked to you by phone about 3 times. Maybe this is the 4th time.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
We usually do everything by email, where we work on other stuff too, and so we catch up at midnight or something like that.
Well, you know, it's funny. I feel like we've developed a relationship over email, like an electronic kind of relationship.
We have, too. And you haven't ever spoken to Eric either. So, guys, here's your opportunity to say hi.
It's a pleasure to meet you for the first time,
Absolutely.
David.
Absolutely. And, you know, I have to say, Eric is kind of the glue that keeps this thing together, because without him getting me the podcast, I wouldn't be able to get them up on the website.
That's right. It's teamwork. It's not an
Absolutely.
Island here.
Well, it's kind of a reflection of the modern world that we live in, that we can have this relationship, all of us. And, I mean, I see you every week, Vicki, but I don't see David. And you said you've only met him a couple times and talked to him on the phone a few times. And yet we all kind of work together, you know, in the modern realm that we have, thanks to technology. It really helps make the show possible.
So. Yeah. And I have to
agree. There's a synergy.
There is a synergy. There is a synergy. And I have to say, one of the things, you know, I will talk about you in a minute, Eric, because I know David has to run. He's doing something today. But so one of the things I love about David is that every so often he'll kick me in the butt and go, Vicki, we need to get this done.
Well, I know you're obsessive about staying ahead of the game as much as possible. And I know a lot of times you have so many lines in the water that I think sometimes, you know, one thing gets slipped by. So I like to make sure that we stay on top of things.
And I appreciate that. And I appreciate you taking ownership for it because, you know, anybody out there listening right now knows that they probably work with a lot of people who do not take ownership for anything. And so that's one thing that I truly appreciate. And it's been a great pleasure working with you. And I hope we continue down this road.
Absolutely. I plan on staying with you as long as you plan on staying on the air. So keep it going.
So what is it you like about working with the radio show?
Oh, it's a lot of fun. It gives me a chance to express a little bit of my creativity. You know, I've got a lot of kind of side writing projects that I'm doing that, you know, who knows if they'll, like, a couple screenplays, things like that. And it's hard to say if that'll ever come to anything. So right. It's nice to be able to do something professional, kind of get my work out there, and I get kind of a redeeming quality to know that somebody somewhere is enjoying my writing and my work.
And we had over a million hits on the website this last, 10 months or so. So I know that a lot of people are reading your work, David.
Well, I don't mean for that to sound somewhat arrogant or selfish, but
no.
That's what I get out of it. And it's contributing to a show that I think you bring a lot of really interesting topics to the forefront.
Well, thanks.
You know, like, I think Test Catchatory is a perfect example. I think a lot of people wouldn't go near the human trafficking thing. And the fact that you're, you know, showing that it's not only something that's prevalent in society, but you're even bringing the local feel into it, that it's happening right here in Seattle.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
I think that's so important.
Yeah.
So I think it's great that you're doing that. The show's fantastic.
Thank you. Well, as I said, it's a team effort, and I know we have to let you go. And I'm so glad you could join us. Thank you. I'm so glad that timing worked out. Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, we'll let you go, David. Have a great day, and we'll have to get you back on again.
Okay. Absolutely.
Okay. Okay, cheerio. All right, that was David Vandiver, and again, a very integral part of our team. And of course, Eric Ryder here is the guy who keeps us live every week and pushes those 9 million buttons over on his station there. He's like a little whiz king, and I just can't even begin to fathom out how many, how you know which buttons to press.
Well, it's just all about, you know, experience here. I got to say one thing I really enjoy about working with you, and it may sound funny, but just the cultural differences that I learned, you being British and but of course, being here in America for so long, but just some of the expressions you use make me smile every week. Like when you say something like whiz king, or we would say whiz kid. You know, it's just kind of...
That's probably a slip of the tongue there. Sometimes I had whole new empathy for George Bush when I started doing radio, because my brain will think one thing, but something else comes out my mouth.
No, I understand that better than probably almost anybody. But maybe that's not the best example, but I remember, about a month ago, you did a interview with... an author who had written about what we call sloths in this country.
Right.
And in Britain, they call them, what do they call them?
Sloths.
Sloths.
Yeah, well,
okay.
I guess that's regional, and it depends where you come from. Uh-huh. Where I come from, which is the right way, no, we say sloth. But
right.
Yeah, it's interesting. It is interesting.
But I like those little differences. They are kind of what makes, you know, life a little bit richer, the variety of life, as they say. But I learn something new each week. Sometimes it's a little cultural thing. Sometimes it's, you know, what the guest is talking about, like... sloths, for instance. I had no idea about sloths or sloths, but we got a pretty in-depth conversation about them, and I appreciated that very much.
Yeah, well, I suddenly saw them in a whole new light, let me tell you. So, well, we have a couple of clips which we're going to play. You know, I was trying to think which, you know, people always ask me who's your favorite guest? Which was your favorite show? Impossible.
Right.
Impossible, because some I like personally, some I like professionally, some I like from an interest factor, some I like just because I like them, you know. But I do always try to bring people who are real experts in their field on, and I think that makes a big difference to, you know, the quality of the information that we're trying to share with people. But again, impossible for me to pick somebody out. So one of the things that I hear the most is how difficult people find changing habits. It doesn't matter if I'm talking to clients, to colleagues, friends, family, listeners, readers, viewers. I've heard it from just about everybody. Well, that's great, but it's so hard to change habits.
I've heard that from many a sloth. They're gonna. I'm gonna get up today and have more energy.
Sloth. No. Sloth.
They can't change.
Well, out of the 6 years, we've done 312 broadcasts. We've had more than 700 guests on over the last 6 years, and as I said, impossible to pick somebody out of the last 12 months. As to who was my favorite. So I thought, let's talk about habits a little bit today. So we're going to play a little bit from a segment from an interview that I did with Charles Duhigg. He's an interesting fellow himself. I mean, he works for the New York Times. He's a professor. He has done all kinds of interesting things. He's an investigative reporter for the New York Times. He's the winner of the National Academy of Sciences, National Journalism, George Polk Awards. He was part of a team of finalists for the 2009 Pulitzer Prize and a frequent contributor to NPR, This American Life, PBS's NewsHour, and Frontline. So right up my street there, he's done some amazing work. And he wrote a fantastic book called The Power of Habit. And one of the things he talks about, he's going to open with the beginning of the interview, and we'll just play a few minutes of it. But he went actually to visit the military, because the military is all about breaking and changing habits. So let's bring that interview on now, if we can, Eric, Charles Duhigg. I want to just begin by looking at how you became fascinated by the science of habit in the first place. You say it was about a decade ago. You were overseas as a news reporter. Tell us about that and how you got involved.
I was in Iraq, and I had heard about this major down in Kufa, which is about an hour south of Baghdad, who was doing experiments to try and stop riots from happening. And he had found that the most successful way to do it was to remove food vendors from the plazas. And that basically what would happen is when crowds would gather to riot, they would get hungry. And if there wasn't anyone there to sell them kebabs, they would all go home. And I asked him how he knew that this would work, that removing the food vendors would stop riots. And what he said was that the U.S. military is essentially this giant machine for changing habits. And that once you learn to recognize how habits work, you can sort of see that they not only occur within individuals' lives, but across groups and communities and societies and organizations. And that it's kind of like getting a pair of glasses that gives you x-ray vision into why people act automatically, and that it had changed his whole view of life. So I got really interested and came back to the U.S. and started researching it.
Yeah, I can understand that. I mean, I was fascinated to read that the general said that the most important thing he learned in the Army was understanding habits. It's all we talk about in command meetings, he said. And he even said that his wife and he write out habit plans for their marriage.
Absolutely, and for their kids. And I have to say, I actually do the same thing. It's enormously powerful. Once you understand how habits work, you know how to change them. And in the last decade, we've learned an enormous amount from neurologists who have been studying habit formation. What we've learned is that every habit has three parts. There's a cue, which is like a trigger for automatic behaviors to start unfolding. And then the behavior itself. And then finally, a reward, which is how your brain learns to remember a pattern for the future. And for years, people focused on the behavior, right? Just what actually happened. But what we've learned in the last decade is it's the cues and the rewards that really shape habits. And that's how we can change and create new ones.
Yeah. So give us an example of how this works. And you had a great one with your cookie example, of course, because your wife was complaining you were getting a little pudgy around the middle there.
Exactly. I had this bad habit where I would go and I would eat a cookie every afternoon. And, I feel like I'm a fairly successful person. And so it was really frustrating to me that I couldn't change this habit. I even put like a little post-it note on my computer monitor saying, no cookies today.
Which, of course, puts cookies in your mind, right?
Exactly. Exactly. I somehow would ignore that every day. And so when I was talking to scientists, I would ask them, you know, how should I change this habit? What they said is the first step is to diagnose the cue and the reward. So I focused on the cue first. I kind of took notes about each day when sort of this cookie urge struck. And what I found pretty quickly is that it always hit between about 3:15 and 3:45 in the afternoon. It was clearly a time of day that was the cue. And then I started working on the reward, because the rewards are really, really important in why habits function the way they do. And so I ran these experiments. Like, you know, I was trying to figure out, was it that I was hungry, and in which case, you know, sort of just buying an apple, mm-hmm. eating that should suffice. Or was it that I wanted the burst of energy that the sugar gave me from the cookie, in which case having a coffee should do the trick. And I kind of went through a whole bunch of different ideas to try and figure out what the reward was, and I eventually figured out the reason I was going up to the cafeteria each day to get a cookie was because that's when I saw my colleagues from work. I'd basically socialize for like 15 or 20 minutes in the cafeteria. And the cookie had just become kind of this convenient excuse to give me a chance to talk to friends. And so once I figured that out, I could reprogram my behavior. And so now every day at about 3:30, I stand up and I look around, and I go find a colleague and walk over to their desk, and we gossip for 15 or 20 minutes, and then I go back to my desk, and the cookie urge is totally gone.
Yeah, it's quite fascinating. It's made me look at my little habits and why I do what I do too. I'm starting to notice patterns there, you know, which is what it's all about, is being aware. Some habits, you say, have the power to start a chain reaction. And this is key, I think, for many people who feel, you know, they might feel overwhelmed or stuck or blocked or in a rut. So talk to us a little bit about what you mean by keystone habits and how that can change our whole life.
Yeah, a keystone habit is one of these habits that when it starts shifting, it seems to set off a chain reaction that causes all types of other changes within someone's life. Keystone habits are essentially more important, the most important habits, because they seem to have this disproportionate power. A good example of this is, for instance, exercise. For a lot of people, exercise is a keystone habit, that when they start exercising habitually, they almost without trying start eating differently. Their eating habits change. And that makes sense, right? Because you're feeling healthy, you want to eat better. But what's interesting is that when people start exercising habitually, they also, on average, start using their credit cards less often.
Oh, that's interesting.
Doing their dishes earlier in the day and being more productive at work, often without even realizing that they're doing it. And that's because exercise is this keystone habit. So it sets off a chain reaction that causes other patterns within our life to change.
Right. I remember that you started the book with a story about a woman whose life was, quite frankly, a mess. I mean, I wouldn't have wanted to be in that situation. She was decided to go to Egypt, and that kind of started turning things around for her. But she'd gone through a divorce, and she smoked heavily and ate too much. And tell us how she changed her life by just thinking that she had to stop smoking.
Yeah, it was really interesting. Her name is Lisa, and she had this really interesting story where her husband had come home and said he wanted it. He was in love with someone else. He wanted to get a divorce. And so she kind of freaks out, and she goes to Egypt. And she's taking a taxi out to the pyramids, and she can sort of see the desert from the taxi. And she decides that she's going to come back and trek across the desert. And the only way that she can survive that is if she quits smoking, which actually, in retrospect, doesn't make any sense, because the way that you trek across the desert is in a car. Food. So you can throw in a pack of smokes. It's not going to make a big difference. But she becomes convinced that she has to give up smoking in order to survive crossing the desert. And so over the next year, she eventually goes back to Egypt and does it. Over the next year, she gives up smoking. And this kind of sets off this chain reaction. It was a keystone habit for her that, you know, she also starts running, and she eventually does a marathon, and she starts eating differently, and she loses a bunch of weight, and she gets a new job, and kind of her whole life changed. But if you ask her why, she'll say it's because she gave up cigarettes. And that's how keystone habits work, is that they tend to become the sort of this emotional focal point or fulcrum that the rest of our life shifts around.
Yeah.
Even if in retrospect that one habit doesn't matter so much, it somehow starts this chain reaction that can echo through a person's entire life.
And that was Charles Duhigg, his book called The Power of Habit. And you can find out more about that interview at conversationslive.net if you want to hear the rest of it. It's just about another 7 or 8 minutes long, but I just find it fascinating. And he goes on to talk about how corporations use it and how Starbucks in particular, because that's up here, how they use it to train their employees. And it's really fascinating stuff. So we're going to talk next about, since we're talking about relationships at the end of the show and we're talking about habits, we're going to talk with a segment from a couple now who have been married, a long time. They have 6 children and they have spent their lives basically teaching others how to have a good and healthy marriage. And I just lost the information here,
Well, are we taking the break and then coming back with that?
We will. We'll take the break first. Let's take the break first, then I can find my notes. I've got too many pieces of paper here. All right, we'll go to a quick break. We'll be right back, and we'll listen to that segment next.
Celebrating 6 years.
Thank you. Celebrate, dance to the music. Celebrate, celebrate, dance to the music.
Celebrate, celebrate, dance to the music. Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. If you think Seattle is exempt from human trafficking, think again. According to those in the know, it's as easy as ordering takeout. We'll talk with Tess Cacciatore, human rights champion and co-founder of Global Women's Empowerment Network, to find out how we can help and what we should look for. Join us Monday at noon Pacific on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Guest details at conversationslive.net.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772. Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Find out about upcoming shows at conversationslive.net.
Tired of the insanity of other talk radio stations? Just click your radio knob and say, "There's no place like Alternative Talk 1150.
Welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. We are celebrating 6 years with Conversations Live. In fact, today is the start of our 7th year. We actually began July 29th, 2007. And so, again, I couldn't pick out a favorite guest or favorite show. And so I thought I'd pick out another segment that people often talk about, and that's relationships. And we did talk with a fascinating couple, Harville Hendricks and Helen LaKelly Hunt. They are the best-selling authors and founders of the Imagia Relationships. Their book is called Making Marriage Simple. And there was a segment at the end here where Harville and Helen talk about compatibility versus incompatibility. And they said, you know, compatibility can breed contempt and boredom. Incompatibility is actually good for relationships. So we're going to hear what they have to say on that and hear a little role play that they did to try and work out a problem. Helen LaKelly Hunt and Harville Hendricks.
There's this myth in the culture that if you're struggling in your marriage, you're married to the wrong person. And I think that's the number one thing. If we could communicate, we would want the public to realize, no, if you're struggling in your marriage, it doesn't mean you're married to the wrong person. It means that some transformation is about to happen. And we think that then is a part of the healing process of marriage.
And it's the incompatibility, that is the feeler-thinker dynamic, or in mine and Helen's case, we have that dynamic. We also have a bunch of other incompatibilities we call complementarity, like Helen is a nester, she likes to be home, I like to wander. I'm very precise about time. Helen has a very relaxed relationship to time.
Relaxed relationship. There's a man who's been married a long time.
That's what she said. So what numbers? It's almost seven. And we can list probably 15 or 20 things. Now, and that's fascinating to us. But what happens is that the tension of these polarities grows both of us because we have to accept that difference in each other, and we also have to still live together. So to live together, we both have to move from our position into a position created by the tension of those polarities. So that moves us into other potential and other potentiality. So we think that incompatibility is somehow built into nature in order to produce the energy for growth.
Mm.
If you were compatible, there's no tension, therefore no energy and boredom. And plus, if you marry the person you fall in love with, you don't have to worry about them being compatible. They will be incompatible at very deep levels. The brain sets it up that way.
Well, I want to ask you to do something, if you would, and that is, you've got some great tools and great exercises in this book, and they are fun, but we literally only have 2 minutes here, but I wanted to ask if we could talk about the behavior change request. Maybe if you could do a little role play on that, to put you on the spot here. But you say negativity is a wish in disguise.
Yeah.
And so if we have a wish, you know, I wish my partner would do X, Y, Z, how do we approach talking to them about it?
So, Helen, I get frustrated when you take liberties with time. So my wish is that when we have an appointment to be at a place for dinner, that you would show up on time or call me if you're going to be late.
So what I'm hearing you say is that you're frustrated when I take liberties with time. And your request is that I will be on time.
Or call me if you're going to be late.
Or call.
So I can adjust my schedule.
Or call when, oh, okay.
Would you be willing to do that?
Well, yes. Yes.
Okay.
Although, are there any other options than calling you?
Well.
Sometimes I can't find the phone.
Yes. When you are there, if you are not on time, if you would just really hug me and tell me that you miss me so much by not being there on time.
Oh, so when I'm late and I haven't called, I need to first think about when I see you, even though I'm late, going up and giving you a big hug and telling you, oh, I am sorry I'm late and I am so glad to be here right now. You're my favorite person in the world. And I'm glad I'm here now.
Or next weekend, you could take me to Paris for dinner.
Or next weekend, if I'm late, then I need to think of taking you on a trip to Paris
for
dinner. Okay. All right. Well, I'll be on time then from now on if I'm in charge of
it. Okay. Awesome. And hopefully that leads to laughter, because that laughter is a great healing tool, right?
It is
a serious process. I understand that. But you say in the dialogue, the goal is not agreement. It's to take turns listening.
That's right. Yes. Agreement is not possible because we're by nature different. But what we have to accept is that we are different, and then not make the other person bad because they're not us. Because that's the deepest pathology. Is to say, you're not like me, and therefore you're awful. There's no way they can not be different, because they are different. That's built into nature. So dialogue helps you understand the other person's world and helps you enter that world and see what it's like for them there, and they enter your world. And then you move from acknowledging that there are two different worlds to appreciating it, accept it. Helen have a little scale called acknowledge, accept, appreciate, admire, adore. And then I'll take your position
as your
advocate.
Right.
And then you're living as partners in a relationship rather than as opponents.
I love it. And very quickly, because we've only got a minute left now of the show, but what if your partner doesn't want to sit down and talk?
Well, one of the best things to do is ask them why, and just listen. And they may say, I don't want to talk about it. And so you go, okay, I'm hearing right now you don't want to talk about it. And 2 days later, ask them again and gently ask them where it's safe for them. And until they begin to tell you, it may be hard to hear all they have to say. So another idea is, if your birthday's coming up or a special day, as a gift, ask that you go to a marriage seminar. Mm-hmm. It could be ours or another one, but say, honey, mm-hmm. I want to go to the marriage seminar to see how I can improve. I want to learn what I need to do so that you feel happier in our relationship.
And the thing I would throw in that would be along with that line is that if my partner doesn't want to talk to me, I've probably made it dangerous for them to talk to me.
Mm, good point.
So I would ask them, how can I make it safe for you to talk to me about something?
Mm, excellent.
And then maybe they can tell me, well, you know, you'll have to listen and not cut me off. You have to listen and not criticize me. You have to listen and not tell me your point of view before I get mine out. So I get an idea how I made it too dangerous for them to talk, so they don't want to talk.
Great advice. They were such a great couple. And again, that interview you can find on conversationslive.net. Just go ahead to our search show if you want to search button if you want to hear more of that interview, and just type in Harvill Hendricks and it will pop straight up. Marriage Made Simple is their book. You know, a couple of my, you do have kind of an allegiance more with some people than others. And I think Judy Blume was just awesome when I talked with her. You enjoyed Judy Blume too, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, growing up, she was one of the big hitters for children's books. When I was a kid, she was kind of like the Harry Potter lady is today, you know?
Yes. So. Yeah. Yeah. And she was just such a pleasant, just such a delight to talk to off air. And I actually pre-recorded that show. And then the following day, I sometimes have to do pre-records, you know, really early in the morning because of other scheduling conflicts. And the following morning, I talked with somebody who couldn't be further polar opposite to Judy Blume, and that was Sue Aikins. Do you remember the National Geographic show? And she lives up in Alaska, like 100 north.
She's kind of a hermit in the old-fashioned sense. I mean, she really has kind of closed herself off from the world. But she was kind enough to talk to us, which was great.
Well, because they were doing a National Geographic show on people who live up there in the wild. You know, her nearest neighbor was like 300 miles away. The 80 plus grizzly bears within a 10-mile radius.
Right.
And she just became my queen of soundbites. She had the best soundbites. She had such a dry wit. And I thought she was just really incredible.
Well, I remember her saying she just didn't like to deal with people, frankly. She was happier dealing with bears, you know, because at least she knew what they were all about, you know?
Yeah, well, there was a photograph, I put it on our Facebook page, of her with a big shotgun. I'm like, I'd not mess with that lady. Even if I was a grizzly bear, I'd be heading in the, in the opposite direction. She said most people worry about break-ins. She worries, you know, her break-ins involve teeth and claws.
Right.
Grizzly bears. So I don't know about you, but we've had some fascinating local people too. And a couple of the people who popped to mind was Diane Mapes was one of them. She's a writer up here in Seattle, and she's quite well known up here in Seattle. And she had a double mastectomy, and mm-hmm. she came on to talk to us about that. And I just was so moved by her openness and her honesty. And I thought she was deserved a mention today, because she's doing a lot for raising awareness on breast cancer just by sharing her journey. And all of these interviews, of course, are on our website, conversationslive.net. And one of the things which surprised me when I was going back through notes and emails, Eric, was, do you remember we did a show on shingles?
Yes. The illness,
yes,
the shingles.
Yeah, we have, yes, not the roofing.
Right.
Yeah, and so I talked with a Seattle doctor up here, a dermatologist. I also talked with a neurologist from New York who's a specialist mm-hmm. in this. And we also had a listener from Seattle join us on that show, just to share different perspectives and viewpoints on that disease, on shingles. And we got so much feedback on that show. It was kind of incredible. I was kind of amazed.
Well, it's something a lot of people can relate to and a lot of people have suffered from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Including yourself, I believe you mentioned on the show that you had.
I did, but we'll forget all about that because we're celebrating today. It was not a fun experience.
Put that out of your memory, of course.
I'm just glad I had what must have been a mild dose because I only had a few spots.
But I think that helped you bring some empathy to the conversation there as you talked to her, being a, you know, someone that's firsthand. I mean, you really did your research on that one, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, that's one way of looking at it. And another of my favorites, and this, again, I received great response from listeners, was Karen Brown, who is a local Seattle entrepreneur herself, just a young woman with two, three kids, I think. And she does an event called Food Opportunity, and you can find out more about that at foodopportunity.com. But
she
just
was
some
fantastic.
Amazing people. Yeah, and I can't tell you how many women wrote in after that interview with Karen. K-E-R-E-N, it's Karen Brown, and said she was such an inspiration to them because they were giving excuses to themselves why they couldn't do stuff, and they'd got a child, and here she is with two or three. I think she's got three because I think she's got twins. So anyway, all of that good stuff's up at conversationslive.net. We've got over 300 podcasts up there, and we're going to get serious in a minute. We're going to go talk with Dr. Jill Weber. She is a clinical psychologist, and we're going to talk about why women have one-sided relationships, why we settle for one-sided relationships. But before we get there, I want to thank you, Eric, for everything you've done over the past 6 years and starting our seventh today.
Likewise. Thank you so much for working with me over the last 6 years. It's been a real pleasure.
We've watched each other age.
Yes. I'd say we still look pretty darn good.
Working on it.
That's right.
All right, we're going to take a very quick break. And before we do that, of course, I want to thank you, our listeners, because you are the heart of everything we do. Without you, we'd have no show. And of course, without our sponsors, we'd have no show. So I thank them, too, from the bottom of my heart, because this is something I just love to do. And I love sharing great information with everyone. All right, we'll take a very quick break. We'll be right back with Dr. Jill Weber.
Did you know that capsizing boats and people falling overboard account for over 70% of boating fatalities? 80% of those fatalities occur on boats under 26 feet and on boats with operators who've had no formal boating instruction. 50% of all boating accidents involve alcohol. Be smart this summer. Know who you're boating with. Wear a Coast Guard approved life jacket and don't drink and boat. This message is brought to you by supporters of Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair and the JMB Group, who wish you safe boating fun.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to BioClean, we cover the world of living successfully with your animal friends. This week, August 4th, it's a Behavior Training and Healing Sunday with me. Since I've been out of the studio for 2 weeks now, we can catch up on all the animal-related happenings we've missed, plus open phone lines so you can call me. I've got answers. Let me help you resolve your animal dilemmas on Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
OMG! Grammar abuse is no LOL! Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW-IMHO. Copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN!
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967 because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at pause.org or call 425-787-2500.
Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has a new Facebook page, so you can see what's happening on our show and what we're up to between shows. Like us on Facebook and look out for upcoming contest drawings.
Body, mind, and spirit. Alternative Talk 1150 covers it all.
Welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. Well, this is, we've been celebrating our 6 years on air today. We're going to get serious now. My guest is Dr. Jill Weber. She's a clinical psychologist who specializes in the impact of culture on female identity and relationship development. And she helps women overcome established negative patterns and helps families understand how to raise girls with good self-esteem. She's appeared as a psychology expert on Nightline, US News and World Report, CNN, and the Discovery Channel, as well as she's been featured in many national publications. And her new book is called Having Sex, Wanting Intimacy, Why Women Settle for One-Sided Relationships. Dr. Jill Weber, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And I want to just kick off here by asking you what fascinated you enough that you decided to specialize in how the culture affects female identity and relationship development? What drove you that path?
Initially I did a lot of research in that area through my undergrad and graduate training just in gender and some of these kind of stereotypes we have about women, particularly in the psychology literature, just looking at the reality of that. Like, are women really more emotional than men? You know, when you look at things like that, you see it's just more complicated. It really kind of depends on what the subject is. Men can be very emotional, too. So I was just kind of interested in that type of thing. But it was really once I started practicing that I put it all together, because this kind of theme just kept coming. Just, you know, I kept hearing with the women I work with, feeling like they can't get the relationship they want and feeling like they keep, you know, down the sort of same dysfunctional pattern. But the part that was hard is they blame themselves. You know, what's wrong with me? And it's interesting because around that time, I happened to be home on maternity leave for a couple of months. And everything on the talk shows was telling women what they're doing wrong. You know, this is what you need to do differently, or the rules to getting the right guy or to meet the right person. And it just kind of struck me at some point, like, wow, I mean, everything is geared toward telling women how to kind of play the game or how to present themselves to get the right match. And in a way, that I think that that's really the problem. So just kind of putting together some of my background in the research with my clinical practice, it just really hit a chord for me.
Right. And you coined this term sex. I can't even say it right
now.
I've said it a million times over the last 2 days. Sextimacy. So tell us what you mean by sextimacy.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, sextimacy is a combination of sex and intimacy. And I just kind of came up with that word as a way to explore this concept. I mean, because what I'm finding is that women who are, you know, some people call it being promiscuous, hooking up, some people have even yuckier names for it. But what I find is that these women are oftentimes using sex as a way to gain more emotional intimacy with men. So maybe they start with a hastened sexual relationship with a man, but really what they're hoping, you know, way back in the back of their mind is that maybe, just maybe, it will lead to more nurturing, it'll lead to more care, or a kind of relationship where they really feel known.
Mm. But you say...
So it's kind of trying to explain what the motive is for women as opposed to judging them for this.
Right. You say at the end of the day, though, this is no choice at all, because women are always left disappointed. Their mood may be down, they may be depressed.
That's right. I mean, it can feel exhilarating in the moment, perhaps, you know, to feel attractive to a particular kind of man and to feel all that attention. But generally, as I describe in the book, it's a sort of cycle where that wears off pretty quickly. You know, perhaps after the sexual event or after the hookup, she's left feeling sort of deflated, like she didn't really get what she wanted, which is to feel like somebody's interested in getting to know more than just one side of her.
Right. And one of the things you talk about in the book, which I think is really important, is how this affects teenagers. Because if a teenager grows up with this with this premise, using sextimacy as a way to, I don't know, gain a little temporary validation. You say the toll is cumulative and very damaging.
That's right. I mean, that part's particularly poignant to me. I think with the way that we kind of raise little girls in our culture can inadvertently set them up for one-sided relationships in adulthood. And I think we've probably all seen it, whether you're a parent or, you know, if you have a friend that's going through this with their child, where a girl maybe starts her dating life, you know, in high school through sextimacy. That is, you know, through hooking up with guys and not really finding a relationship with a guy who really wants to know and who she is. And that's a particularly damaging kind of cycle, although in my experience, I think it's a very common one. Because what happens is, by the time she enters college or she gets older, maybe she's more and more aware, I really want a more serious relationship with somebody or somebody who can take me seriously. But at that point, it becomes really awkward or hard for her to engage men on a non-sexual level. You know, she's just been so used to doing it that way that she might feel uncomfortable herself with more intimacy.
Right.
In other words, being more herself.
Right. So it's like a never-ending cycle, as you say, then, really, because they just keep feeding that same pattern and never really grow or evolve out of it. And you say that can cause, you know, emotional and relationship development issues along the way, all of their life.
It really can. And, since writing this book, I've gotten a few emails from adult women who have had that problem. And I think that what I really hear is the loss of self-esteem. So they go through the pattern over and over again, and they beat themselves up, and they hate themselves for it. What's wrong with me? And, you know, that just makes it worse because you kind of feel like you're not good enough to find the right match. But that's exactly right. And my idea from this book is really it's not quite like that. These are strategies. There are ways that you can evolve and sort of train yourself to cultivate healthier relationships with men. But you have to have that awareness that you're doing this over and over again. A lot of women have that part. But then you also need to feel like you have some ways to get out of that.
Yeah. You say that at the heart of these trials is a lack of understanding and acceptance of themselves. And some of the fallout of that is that they often feel painfully self-conscious about their bodies, which kind of you'd think if they felt that way, they wouldn't want to be sextimacy. They'd want to hide away and learn to develop those emotional relations. And again, I'm not judging. It's just there's a lot of contradictory, feeling for them.
But, yeah, you're absolutely right about that. I know. And it is kind of counterintuitive. But, you know, oftentimes, particularly with girls, what can happen is, because girls are sort of oftentimes they come to the world already sort of being more pleasing, more accommodating, more aware of emotions and social cues. And then if they're in a family environment that sort of exploits those traits, then they kind of just get trained up to be pleasing to others, to look good enough for other people, to hear you're good, to hear you're smart, to hear you're pretty. And they work really hard to get that approval from people. And if that kind of continues to go unfettered or unchallenged, and then that just kind of sets them up to want this from men as well.
Mm-hmm.
And although, yeah, they might feel self-conscious about their body, they might not feel like they look good enough, but if they feel that attraction from a man, even in the moment, that can feel like, oh, maybe there's hope. Maybe I am good enough. You know, if I could just secure this attraction, maybe I will get what I want. Maybe I'll actually get the man. So it can feel very intoxicating in the moment for a woman who struggles with self-esteem and body image to feel attracted to an attractive man.
Right.
But sometimes it's short-sighted, just kind of not looking at it in terms of the long-term picture, how you're going to feel the next day or the next week.
So if we have daughters, because you talk in the book about how caregivers, and we just touched on this a little, how caregivers in childhood can really impact how a girl sees men as she grows up. If we have daughters, we want to ensure what? That they get the right kind of attention. And what would that be?
That's right. And again, that's kind of contradictory, too. I mean, a lot of people say, kind of go in extremes on this. Like, well, we shouldn't just say they're beautiful, you know. But of course we shouldn't. We shouldn't just focus on appearance with girls. And that obviously has a big impact. On the other hand, you can't not focus on appearance at all because that makes them feel weird. You can't just notice at all how they appear. So I think that's sort of an extreme view. But on the other hand, what we can do is really try to push them more and more toward doing things that they enjoy, actually doing things. I mean, I have a baby girl, so I'm just beginning at this, but you know, what I notice is a lot of the products out there for girls are really, they don't do things. You know, they're you know, a doll or an item. I mean, you can do things with dolls, of course, but you have to encourage them to play that way, you know, to be creative in their thinking. Certainly things like sports, you know, but so what you're doing is basically encouraging their effort, encouraging them to do things that they enjoy. Did you like that? How'd it go? Not so much, oh, you really did well at that. Oh, you were perfect at that. But more sort of how they felt about the experience. So you're kind of simultaneously encouraging them to do things that they like and to notice what they like and what they don't like. And that also encourages them to be emotionally intimate with you. So if you're just telling them to do things, you got to get straight A's, you got to go play soccer, you got to go hang out at Susie's house, you got to wear that cute dress, that doesn't breed emotional intimacy. And what does is just to ask them about how they're experiencing their life. What do they like? What don't they like? What's hard for them? And trying to de-emphasize appearance and the external.
Right.
I don't know. That was kind of convoluted. But
No, that made perfect sense. That made perfect sense. So the bottom line, really, you know, if we're experiencing sextimacy over and over and over and over again, it's a huge part of it is because we're not expressing ourselves. We're not aware of ourselves. We're not accepting ourselves or even acknowledging our real feelings. So let's look at how we start to turn that around, because I think at the end of the day, you know, and I have actually known men who you know, participate in this too. So at the end
Absolutely.
Of at the end of the day, I think people do want that emotional connection, the long-lasting relationship. So what is it we can do to start turning around to become more self-aware?
Okay, that's a great question. So if you find you're in this pattern, maybe you're aware of that part. Now what? And I think it's a combination of things. So you want to keep dating. You want to keep trying to meet people. It's not as if you can't do that. But simultaneously, you've got to work on yourself. You've got to work on feeling better about who you are as a person. And the way I look at that part, the self-esteem part, is accept that you are the way you are, but also challenge yourself to grow. So, but instead of saying, like, oh, I wish my hair was better, I wish my weight was better, you know, these kind of external things that we hang everything on, look at it a little bit differently. I wish I was more open about myself, or I wish I would try this new hobby that I've been wishing I you know, that I've been wanting to do for a long time, or try new social situations that perhaps don't come easy to you. So in other words, challenge yourself with new situations, new people. And also that's a nice way to meet different types of men, because sometimes women who are in this pattern tend to constantly meet the same kind of man
right.
over and over again. And if you keep going to the same places and being around the same people, that's going to happen. So you do have to challenge yourself with new activities, new social circles. And you have to learn to be alone at the same time. So again, that's kind of contradictory, you know, go out, date, try new things. But at the same time, when you're on your own, try to find ways to be at peace with that and to eventually even enjoy it. I mean, I know that sounds kind of, that's something that a lot of people say, but it is really important to begin to find ways to be alone and to be comfortable with that. And what that means is you find ways to spend your time where you're at ease and you're relaxed and, find meaning in it, you know, that being alone and finding ways to enjoy that really often does make you a better partner at a different time in the future, because it means you kind of have your stuff together. You're not needing a man to complete you.
He's That's just right.
You know, he's just the extra topping on your on your life.
He's the cream.
As opposed to being, oh, I have to have him or else I won't be okay.
Yeah, I think that's so key. And if you look at partners, you know, the ones that are more whole are those who are not afraid to be alone. We're almost right at the end of our segment.
Okay.
And I want to ask you really quickly, and I know you can't properly answer this for me, but, you know, Anthony Weiner pops to mind.
Yes. Oh, and, I'm so glad you're asking about that.
And why, I mean, his wife is standing by him. And obviously people do this for a number of reasons, you know, especially the politicians. You see the politicians come out and apologize for their stupidity and wife is standing there looking heartbroken and depressed. Why do these women stay there over and over?
I mean, and of course I can't say,
right,
I can't
right.
say why in that case, but I think sometimes, and particularly for women, and of course some men too, we just want to believe so badly that we can help a person change. And I think sometimes, again, we're sort of trained up to have so much empathy and so much compassion for people that we can think about things from their perspective to our own detriment.
Yeah.
But perhaps there's reasons for this. I'm sure this guy has some complications in his life and reasons why he struggles with this. And so you can think about that so much that maybe you forget, yeah, but this might not be the right match for me. This might not be good for my future. And that I see that a lot in my work with women.
Right.
And you have support to really think, even though he may have all kinds of reasons for you to have empathy for him, it's really important to put yourself first. You have to think about what's in your long-term best interest.
Great advice. This is a really good book. It's called Having Sex, Wanting Intimacy, Why Women Settle for One-Sided Relationships. So if you have this issue, you have friends or family members, this is a great book because Dr. Weber goes into great detail about how you can overcome this situation. There are a lot of tools and resources in there. And bottom line, self-awareness is key, and dating with self-awareness in particular. Dr. Weber, thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. That was wonderful.
And you, I'm almost out of time here, but you were our very first guest on the start of our 7th year. So,
yay!
Yay!
Wonderful.
And listeners, you can find out more about Dr. Jill Weber at drjillweber.com, and Weber has one B in it. And you can find out more about us at conversationslive.net. I so appreciate you tuning in today. And if you enjoy our show, tell someone where they can find it, conversationslive.net. And you can also find me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair. Thanks for being with us. Until next week, live well, live strong.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.